And our special guest tonight is Nick Redfern with his book, Science Fiction Secrets, and we'll have more of them when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Nick Redfern, our guest. Nick, let's talk about the Lone Gunman, this eerie story. Tell me about this.
Yeah, this is a very, very, very strange and almost disturbing one, George. The Lone Gunman, some of the listeners, may recognize, were a trio of characters who made guest appearances on The X-Files in the 1990s, who often gave assistance to Mulder and Scully in various, usually alien-dominated adventures. And within the show, as far as the fans are concerned, they became very, very popular and had, you know, more and more repeated guest appearances. And I guess ultimately received the ultimate accolade in 2001 when they actually got their own spin-off series called The Lone Gunman. Now, although it was popular with the fans, it didn't last long and just actually ran for one series. Now, the series started on March the 4th, 2001, and it began in a style that I guess still creates controversy today, but certainly not for reasons that could have been foreseen at the time. And that's because the very first episode, the pilot episode, dealt with the storyline. We dealt with the hijacking of a Boeing 727 passenger aircraft by a hostile computer hacker who then takes control of the plane's computer flight system and directs it to fly from its departure point in Boston straight into one of the towers of the New York World Trade Center. And in fact, the climatic sequence shows the 727 heading straight for one of the towers, but thanks to the efforts of the lone gunman at the last minute, they succeed in hacking into the computer-controlled system, and the pilots are finally able to regain control of the plane at the last second, and they manage to avoid the tower by literally inches. And when the episode was being made, a special aerial crew used a helicopter to fly low over Manhattan at night and directly towards the World Trade Center to film the background footage for the plane's approach. Now, in that particular episode, the purpose of the attack is to increase the U.S. military defense budget by blaming the attack on foreign dictators who are, quote, begging to be smart bombed. And in Australia, the episode actually aired on August the 30th, 2001, less than 2 weeks before the 9/11 attacks. So, in other words, we have this scenario of a TV science fiction drama dealing with a planned attack on the World Trade Centers, which isn't what it appears to be, and which appears to actually have at its heart attempts, if you like, to blame it on Middle East dictators who can then be attacked in return, which, of course, you know, is not dissimilar to a number of scenarios that have been put forward for the real 9/11 attacks. And, of course, this opens, you know, a whole can of worms as to, you know, is it possible, as some people have theorized, that someone, you know, watch the program and literally thought that would actually be, you know, feasible and doable. You know, it sounds controversial. It sounds terrible if it could have been true. But is it possible that somebody used that as a springboard, you know, for the atrocities that did occur on 9/11?
You know, Chris Carter was one of the originators of the Lone Gunman, as he was the X-Files.
That's correct, yes. And actually, a number of people who worked on the on the Lone Gunman, who also worked on the X-Files, actually commented on this sort of bizarre, eerie scenario after the attacks occurred. For example, Frank Spotnitz, who was one of the Lone Gunman's four executive producers, said, "I woke up on September the 11th and saw it on TV, and the first thing I thought of was the Lone Gunman. But then in the weeks and months that followed, almost no one noticed the connection. What's disturbing about it to me is you think as a fiction writer that if you can imagine this scenario, then the people in power and the governments who are there to imagine disaster scenarios can imagine it too." That was the end of his quote. Now, Robert McLachlan, who was the director of photography on the series, he said, "It was odd that nobody referenced it. In the ensuing press, nobody mentioned that it echoed something. 9/11 echoed something that had been seen before, albeit in a, you know, a sci-fi drama."
Nick, has anybody gotten to the writer or whoever was the one who created this episode?
Well, not to the best of my knowledge. I mean,
I want to ask that person how he came up with the idea.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, you know, I think in terms of the, you know, the TV show, I would want to stress, I think they were wholly innocent. That was, you know, it was nothing to do with them. But the questions that have been asked are if someone else picked up on that particular scenario and ran with the scenario.
Well, but would that have given them enough time?
Well, you know, that's again one of the big questions, you know, in terms of how something like this could have been planned and initiated if that was indeed the case. You know, other people have suggested it was just some sort of really bizarre synchronicity. But then again, you know, who believes in coincidences and synchronicities?
You know, I don't.
So, you know, it's one of these strange and disturbing stories where truth, in some cases, actually isn't stranger than fiction. You know, it's actually the other way around in this particular case, that the fiction's stranger because something terrible and very close to it actually ultimately did come true.
You know what? I think we're going to try to track them down. That might be an interesting little story.
Just to find
out how it came about and what they thought about it. And, you know, I wonder if anybody ever just gave them an idea. And who was that person who gave them the idea?
Well, I think, you know, from my perspective, I think the most interesting thing about it all is that, as a number of commentators have rightly said, and as I, you know, just mentioned in the quotes, that it seems that the entire media just overlooked this or conveniently forgot about it. You know, such questions were never asked as to how such a closely, you know, parallel story could have occurred in fiction and then it occurred in fact. You know, that the news outlets that obviously followed 9/11 on the day of the attacks and right after, nobody was talking about this episode. Now, some people might say, well, in the wake of such a tragedy, you know, discussing a sci-fi TV drama is sort of superfluous and you know, not even relevant. But I would say it is relevant in the sense that the storyline is so close that I would have thought someone would have looked into it.
Yeah, you would have thought so. It's fascinating. It really is. Did the FBI secretly spy on science fiction authors, and why?
Yeah, actually, George, this is one of the areas where I had some successes and some problems in getting files. One of the things I found, and this was purely through just trawling through numerous government archives, was that the FBI, for example, had a file on Aldous Huxley, who wrote the novel Brave New World.
Mm-hmm.
And as I began to dig deeper, I found that there was a CIA file on George Orwell, who wrote 1984 and Animal Farm. And there was an FBI file on him as well. So I began to think, well, you know, are there any other authors who have been the subject of government files? And I found Philip K. Dick. He had an FBI file.
Blade Runner, right?
Yeah. He was the author of the book that led to the Blade Runner movie with Harrison Ford. And I found, again, there were numerous reasons why famous sci-fi authors were being secretly watched by the government. Now, certainly in the case of George Orwell and Aldous Huxley, it was primarily because they were talking about future so-called utopian societies and, again, the perils that can go along with an allegedly utopian society. You know, it's not always a good thing when you have, like, a slave population that's just blissfully unaware and doesn't care about anything, you know, that they are as bad as a slave race. And that's basically, you know, what Huxley was warning about. And obviously Orwell was talking about like a totalitarian future. So one of the things I found was that the government agencies were watching them to see what effect their books had on the general public. And in some cases, even in schools, you know, with them being taught in schools and what the effect and fallout might be on the children who are reading the books, you know, what were their views, etc. Now, the strangest file of all was the file on Philip K. Dick, because he actually initiated the contact with the FBI. This is one of the things that sort of sets him apart, because obviously, you know, a lot of the authors probably didn't even know that they were being watched. You know, it was a case of the FBI or whoever doing this behind closed doors. But Philip K. Dick actually approached the FBI himself because he had major concerns. This was in the mid-1970s. And he had got onto a story where he felt that there were certain extreme right-wingers, almost like Nazis, who were actually exploiting and manipulating the world of science fiction by having their belief systems secretly or, I guess, clandestinely and subliminally inserted into the page of science fiction novels to, I guess, get people acclimatized to ultra-right-wing views and even kind of try to win them over. And Dick came to this very, very, I guess, controversial conclusion that certain people were actively approaching science fiction authors and trying to get them to do this, to incorporate storylines that were sympathetic to ultra-right-wing views. And he talked in the letters about how when he was digging into this, for example, he was the subject of burglaries, and the FBI was watching him and hassling him, and he became quite paranoid about the whole situation of believing he'd stumbled across this huge conspiracy that was exploiting and molding, manipulating the world of science fiction. And the files, at least, don't reflect if this conspiracy did exist. But certainly in his letters to the FBI, Philip K. Dick, who was obviously, you know, a respected science fiction author with major books to his name, actually spelled it out in great detail with names, places, etc., of people who he believed were involved and how it was going to be carried out. And, you know, it's a very, very strange story of a man, I guess, feeling he was totally alone and having stumbled across this huge conspiracy.
Remember the comic book series and the cartoon series Dick Tracy?
Mm.
The technology that was in that that cartoon and in the comic books, cutting edge, Nick.
Yeah.
Cutting edge, you know, little phones that you could talk to, little tiny TVs, little everything.
Yeah.
Cutting edge. The United States Air Force looked at the idea of developing teleportation.
Yeah, I mean, this, obviously, teleportation is, I guess, the sort of technology that anyone would dream, you know, it would be everybody's dream to be able to just, you know, do away with aircraft, no long-haul flights across the Atlantic from one country to another. The idea that we could scramble our atoms in one location and have them dispatched to another and then reconvened somewhere else. Kind of like the scenario that worked very well in Star Trek and that didn't work too well at all in The Fly. You know, Star Trek has this transporter beam to beam the crew down to whichever planet, whereas in The Fly, the unfortunate scientist, you know, gets in the transporter machine, not knowing there's a little fly in there.
Yeah, it would have worked had the fly not been in there.
Yeah,
huh?
A pesky little fly, yeah. So that's, you know, the scenario in science fiction. But it's quite true that only a few years ago, the Air Force actually contracted a project out to determine if teleportation in various formats was actually feasible. And they talked about the classic type of teleportation that's seen in things like Star Trek and The Fly. They also talked about psychic teleportation, described as the conveyance of persons or inanimate objects by psychic means, and various other highly advanced means of teleportation. Now, you know, one of the things that I think it's important to stress about this is that, of course, the military is always looking on the lookout for new and novel military weapons.
Sure.
And, you know, things that can kind of take things to the next level. And I think that's what happened with this particular study, that they were, again, kind of fishing for a new angle in terms of fighting on the battlefield, in terms of getting troops into different locations, etc.
Science is working on teleportation machines now.
Oh, yes. As far as this report's concerned, it goes into very, very great detail about the feasibility or otherwise of doing it and how it might be achieved and things like that. And certainly the Air Force, you did look at it to a great extent. Now, we only actually have, of course, this one particular report in the public domain right now. The big question, of course, is to what extent there might be other reports of a far, I guess, more classified level, top secret level, that haven't surfaced yet. Of course, that's speculation, but it's typically been the case in my experience that, you know, when you begin to look into these subjects, you find that everybody and his brother is looking into these things. Like UFOs, you know, we thought Project Blue Book was the only operation to investigate UFOs. Then we find the CIA, the Air Force, the FBI, the DIA, everybody was looking into it. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if other agencies have followed the lead of the Air Force in, you know, trying to perfect teleportation. But certainly this is one that, you know, unquestionably in my mind, wouldn't have existed had it not been for the springboard, you know, that's been taken from the world of science fiction and how sci-fi visionaries, you know, envisioned using teleportation.
Nick, there was a fellow by the name of Mike Conrad. He was a filmmaker in the 50s. You write about him, who was doing a movie about UFOs in Alaska, and the Air Force was all over him. How come?
Yeah, this is a very weird story, which again is full of strange synchronicities. This story I stumbled upon when I was at the National Archives in Maryland, and I was going through some old UFO files from the late 40s and early 50s, which had been declassified by the Air Force, and actually came across a surveillance file on this author, excuse me, on this filmmaker and actor, Michael Conrad. And basically, the storyline is that Conrad was sort of like a bit part actor. He never really achieved, you know, major fame or anything like that. He was always second or third fiddle. And he wrote, directed, produced, and starred in this pretty low-budget film called The Flying Saucer, which, as you can guess, is about flying saucers.
Yeah.
Set in Alaska. And the premise is kind of interesting. It deals with an FBI agent who goes in search of the truth about flying saucers, which have been seen flying around the skies of Alaska. And Conrad plays one of the lead parts. And, of course, there's a beautiful woman to accompany him. And it's sort of a classic, you know, early 50s sci-fi movie. Well, when the film was in pre-production, to give it some publicity, Conrad started, you know, doing press interviews, and he made a fatal mistake. Instead of just trying to promote the film and saying, you know, it was going to be good and there was going to be good special effects in it, he actually started to lie. And what he said was that he got real film footage of UFOs flying in the skies of Alaska, and that this footage would be incorporated into the film. And now, he actually didn't have any footage. He was basically just trying to promote his film like a, you know, a used car salesman or something like that. but what happened was that, rather ironically, and this is why the Air Force got involved, at the same time that Conrad was fabricating stories to promote his film about UFOs flying over Alaska, the Air Force was actually secretly investigating real sightings of UFOs over Alaska.
And they probably didn't know what he knew.
No, that's right.
Or they didn't know.
No, and it really put the red flags up, because I actually got hold of all these files, and they originated with people like the Navy, the Air Force, the FBI, a lot of very credible military reports and radar reports of fast-moving, brightly lit objects flying over the Alaskan skyline in both daylight and nighttime. Very credible in-depth reports from the military of chasing these things and just not being able to catch them or identify them. So, of course, when Conrad started saying he got this film footage, the Air Force wanted to know what it was that he got and opened this surveillance file on him. And I actually found that three or four officers of the Air Force's Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI.
We have always heard about a false flag, a phony UFO invasion. We'll talk with you about that next, Nick, on Coast to Coast AM. Yes, you are. Streamlink. To those of you who do not have it, we are now allowing 2 years for you to go back and get the downloads of past programs. Technology has caught up with us finally, and we're able to do that. And now they're working on year number three. So it's a great deal, 15 cents a day for Streamlink, which you can pick up by going to coasttocoastam.com. We have always heard rumors, Nick, that if the New World Order takes over, it could be under the guise of a false flag, a phony UFO invasion, to try to get this world to band together. And you have looked into this.
Yeah, I mean, This is, I guess, one of the more unusual and intriguing stories in the book. It actually goes back to 1948, at the very sort of dawning of the flying saucer era, only 1 year after Kenneth Arnold's famous encounter in June 1947. And this relates to a novel called The Flying Saucer, written by a man named Bernard Newman. And Newman was the author, a prolific author. He wrote more than 100 books on subjects ranging from espionage, global politics, and current affairs, which is kind of interesting, you know, that he covered all those areas. But it was his, I guess, brief foray into science fiction and actually crashed UFOs that was perhaps most notable and relevant. Now, The Flying Saucer tells the story of an elite group of scientists who decide to secretly stage a series of fake UFO crashes with the express purpose of attempting to combine the world under one government against a deadly alien foe who actually doesn't even exist. It's just something that they conjure up.
Yes.
Now, it appears that Newman's novel was actually prompted by a speech made by the former British Prime Minister, Sir Anthony Eden, in 1947, who said, quote, "It seems to be an unfortunate fact that the nations of the world were only really united when they were facing a common menace. What we really needed was an attack from Mars." And then, of course, you know, you have Newman's novel coming right after. But the novel itself, The Flying Saucer, tells of the secret construction of a number of UFO-type craft by scientists who then deliberately crashed them in three specific locations: New Mexico, Russia, and England. And the crash sites are carefully chosen by the scientists because they relate to the three major powers that emerged out of the Second World War. But the scientists sort of take it a further stage, and they even create a faked alien body, which is made from the remains of a number of sort of pulverized exotic animals.
Making it look real.
Making it look real, and then they present the evidence to the on the world stage, the media, etc. And as a result of this, all the various differences between the governments of the Earth kind of dissolve under this non-existent Martian threat. And basically, the nations of the Earth come together as one, which isn't necessarily a good thing if you've got the wrong person manipulating the scenario.
That's right.
Now, what makes the story even more interesting is...
And believable.
And believable, yeah, is that Newman himself actually has a quite notable background. For example, in 1945, the New York Times described him during the Second World War as actually acting as a double agent for the Allies in German intelligence. He's also known to have prepared classified reports for the British government and the British military on rocket sites in Germany during the Second World War, where the V-1 and V-2 rockets were built. So, in other words, not only was he an author talking about how, you know, some sort of almost like a new world order could be ushered in, but he already had a foot in the door quite deeply in the secret world of espionage and government spying and intelligence.
That is amazing.
So, you know, the big question that's being asked is it possible that Newman was actually aware that perhaps someone or some group within the military had at least considered this scenario of, you know, creating like a false flag scenario, and that he then was inspired to use it in his novel. And, you know, speculation has been put forward that perhaps he was trying to help them and assist them to usher this in, or he was presenting his book as a warning in case someone ever did try to do it.
Well, you know what? You look at the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. Mm. You look at the supposed rumors about Pearl Harbor and what we did or did not know. Mm. We know that then Vice President Dick Cheney tried to concoct an idea to have Navy SEALs dressed up like Iranians and, you know, try to do some things. I mean, I wouldn't put it past anybody to try to concoct some kind of a plan for this push for a one-world government, Nick. Mm.
Well, you know, I find it interesting, George, that over the years we've heard rumors of, you know, attempts by the military to develop craft that look like what we see in UFO reports,
sure,
classic flying saucers. And, you know, I sometimes wonder, are they just looking to determine if flying saucers are feasible, or are they trying to replicate them purely for this particular purpose? You know, somebody wants to create the idea and the scenario of hostile aliens when, you know, as I point out in the book, maybe if this ever occurs, the crews actually won't be little grey men from Zeta Reticuli. They'll be rather big and burly men in standard-issue flight suits. We'll never know.
Why does government and intelligence agencies continue to monitor TV shows, movies? I know they listen to this program as well. What kind of information are they trying to get?
Well, you know, I think it's several things, George. I think one is to see if there are any whistleblowers out there talking about things they shouldn't be to people like me and you. I think another one is actually to try and get ideas for scenarios that they may wish to use. You know, for example, the very fact that we're talking about things like false flags and UFOs and, you know, kind of manipulation of the public with an alien threat. Maybe, you know, the idea is to listen in and just to see to what extent such scenarios are believed, or if people wave them to one side, and if people dismiss them, that actually makes their job easier because people aren't looking, you know, to blow the cover on these events. So I think it's probably several reasons like that why they take so much notice. And I think also, as I point out in the book, to get inspiration from the world of science fiction for things like, you know, looking into the feasibility of teleportation or invisibility. You know, science fiction acts as a springboard for ideas as well.
We've heard about Tesla's death ray. Yet I truly believe the U.S. has continued to try to build some kind of weaponry like that.
I mean, again, you know, we can actually trace a lot of the early references to things like death rays and ray guns to the world of science fiction. You know, it's actually found it quite amazing the extent to which, you know, the science fiction came first and then the science technology, if you like, came after it. I mean, there are several classic examples of this, for example. Again, you know, H.G. Wells with The War of the Worlds, the James Bond story Goldfinger, Babylon 5, Resident Evil, Star Wars with the lightsabers. You know, you have numerous outlets where ray guns, ray technology has been used. But yeah, you're quite right that one of the most famous stories, I guess, is that of Nikola Tesla, the maverick and brilliant scientist who reportedly developed some sort of death ray. And actually, there are various stories that link his testing of this supposed death ray with the huge explosion at Tunguska, Russia in 1908, you know, which is a controversial event in itself. But there are tales that kind of link Tesla in some way with this particular explosion, that he may have been testing something that went wrong and led to this event.
Interesting. Yeah,
so, you know, again, I think we can certainly look at science fiction as using this as a springboard.
Well, you know, during the atomic testing prior to dropping the bomb, of course, they thought that there was that possibility that they could ignite the atmosphere.
Yeah, nobody, that's the reckless thing. Nobody really knew what the outcome was going to be when the first atomic bomb went off. And it was just a case of really, you know, hang on to your hat and hope for the best.
Yeah, exactly. The author of Gulliver's Travels, Jonathan Swift, wrote about the planet Mars having two moons. Now, that was about 150 plus years before they were discovered.
Yeah, this is...
How did he pull this off?
Well, that's one of these stories that I think, to an extent, it's unlikely we'll ever get an answer that's going to satisfy everybody. But, yeah, you're quite right. Gulliver's Travels, written by Jonathan Swift, was published first in 1726, and Swift had actually been working on the novel for, I think, something like 10, 11 years before it was actually published, and finally saw the light of day. And, you know, as you quite rightly mentioned, the book itself talks about two moons orbiting the planet Mars, and here's a quote from the book. Scientists have discovered two lesser stars or satellites which revolve about Mars, whereof the innermost is distant from the center of the primary planet, exactly three of its diameters, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes into pretty detailed, to a detailed extent, about the nature of the moons, their orbits and distance from Mars, et cetera. Now, this is all well and good, of course, since science and astronomy have shown us that the planet Mars does have two moons, Phobos and Deimos. The problem is that it was actually 151 years after Gulliver's Travels was published that the two moons were actually first officially discovered. And this was by a man named Asaph Hall, who worked at the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. It was actually in August 1877 when they were discovered, and it was 1726 when Swift wrote his book. Now, certainly Swift didn't get the distance from the surface of Mars and the orbital speeds of the moons quite correct. But, you know, for somebody who was not even, had no particular expertise in astronomy, to actually get it pretty close 150 years before is pretty significant. And, of course, this has led to a whole range of different theories and ideas, one being that possibly Swift had access to ancient and arcane manuscripts from some, you know, previous civilization on Earth that destroyed itself, kind of, you know, like the Atlantean scenario. Then there's a very weird scenario, one I don't personally hold to, but it is out there, the idea that Swift was actually a human-like Martian living amongst this disguise.
That could be the long shot, right?
I think that's the very long shot. We have these, I guess, fragmentary aspects to the story where no one's ever going to really be satisfied or understand how and why it happened. But the fact is, you know, it did happen. Now, there is one possible answer, and it involves something called celestial harmony, which was a theory quite popular at the time, the idea being that as the planets go outward from the sun, they would have more and more satellites orbiting around them. And it was known that the Earth had one. And so the theory was that Mars might have two, Saturn three, Jupiter four, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we know today that that theory simply doesn't hold, but some people have postulated that maybe it was purely coincidence and that Swift was using this theory of celestial harmony, which could be the case. But then again, you know, to be not too far off in these predictions of distance, of the distance from the planet, the orbits, et cetera, you begin to wonder, you know, did he have some sort of access to ancient texts? I mean, there's no doubt, you know, we look at, for example, things like Stonehenge, the pyramids, the Mayans, you know, all races of people very, very advanced in their own way with a fascination with technology, with mathematics, with astronomy. So it's not out of the question that, you know, ancient knowledge might have existed relative to the Martian moons.
Jack Kirby wrote he's a comic book artist.
Yeah.
He had the story of the face on Mars 20 years before NASA revealed the Viking photographs.
Yeah, this is like another weird story where science fiction preempts science fact, just as Jonathan Swift did with the Martian moons. I'm sure everybody listening to the show right now has heard of the so-called face on Mars. This
Cydonia.
Yeah, it's Cydonia, this huge structure that looks like a carved ancient face and has become known as the face on Mars. Well, again, what's not very well known, but again parallels the Gulliver's Travel story, is that back in the 1950s, Jack Kirby, who worked on some of the famous early superhero characters for Marvel Comics, characters like Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, characters like that, actually wrote a comic book called The Face on Mars. And the pictures actually very, very eerily parallel the real face.
How weird is this?
Yeah, it's very, very weird. And, I mean, in the story, it actually tells the tale of a team of astronauts led by an astronaut named Ben Fisher that go to Mars. And on arriving, Fisher and his colleagues, they find this huge monolithic carved human-like face on the surface. And Fisher climbs it and discovers that the eye sockets are actually entrance points to a hidden realm that's buried deep within the face. And inside, he uncovers like a lush land that's published by a band of giant-sized alien beings. So, you know, it tells like an adventure story, which obviously is what Kirby did well. But the parallels are so close to be, you know, almost jaw-dropping, even to the fact that he, you know, he called it the face on Mars. And when you also consider that here's someone else like Jonathan Swift who preempted the official discovery, of this particular structure, you begin to wonder, you know, does somebody know something that we don't?
Yeah, and sadly, he died in 1994. We can't get the answer from him.
No, unfortunately, we're not able to get the answer to this day. I mean, you know, I think that's one of the problem, particularly with some of these old stories, that they go to the grave with the person that put them out there.
Especially now, Nick, knowing what we know about events that have unfolded, how cool would it be to be able to go back to someone like a Kirby and say, okay, Jack, 20 years before we found out about this, you had it.
Yes.
How'd you do it?
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, this isn't something that's, I mean, although it's been discussed before, it's not something widely known, you know, as far as people pressing NASA to say, well, hang on a minute, you know, you put these pictures out in the late 70s. Here's a guy actually presenting it in a fictional format in a comic book with the same name 20 years before. What's going on? And I actually think, you know, if we push this angle a bit further, we might potentially uncover some interesting things. This actually wasn't the only time when Kirby was involved, for example, in the world of, I guess, government secrecy, official secrecy. He was actually also tangentially involved in an operation which was designed to get a number of U.S. hostages out of Iran when the American embassy siege occurred in Tehran in 1979. And the plan was to smuggle the hostages out and have them parade straight through Tehran airport back to the U.S. by passing them off as Canadian filmmakers making a science fiction film in Iran. And Kirby was going to be enlisted to do some promotional artwork, etc., to, I guess, enhance the idea that this was a real film production rather than an attempt to clandestinely get some State Department employees out of Iran. And so he was involved in that as well. And, you know, you see little things like this, little snippets, and you begin to wonder, is there a bigger jigsaw to be put together?
These are amazing stories, Nick. I mean, they just make you just scratch your head and shake your head.
Well, you know, they actually do, George, because I think on the one hand, it gives us a great insight into how science fiction and conspiracies have crossed paths. But equally, it suggests that we don't really know half the stories and the truth. But it seems there's a far bigger picture going on where science fiction and conspiracies seem to be almost like regular bedfellows. You know, they're hand in glove. And I sometimes wonder if, you know, that somebody's actually deliberately doing this. There's actually a concerted effort to infiltrate the world of science fiction and use it for a whole variety of reasons.
Nick, we're going to take phone calls with you at the top of the hour, and then we're also going to talk more about some of these still incredible stories. Now, your work, Science Fiction Secrets, where do you get this book?
Well, it's published by Anomalous Books, anomalousbooks.com, and it's available at all good outlets, online outlets, and major bookstores as well.
It is a great read, and there's more fascinating stories to talk about. For example, why did the British Ministry of Defense get involved with a BBC science fiction TV series about an alien invasion? What are they trying to pass on to us? In a moment, we'll take your phone calls. Nick Redfern, our special guest, the final hour tonight. Joshua Warren joins us with his weekly Paranormal Moment Hour. We'll be back.